This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Is the dream of a civilization powered by the wind, the sun, and water just that, a dream that cannot become a reality? Our guest, Ken Caldera, argues that solar and wind power can take us a long way, but not all the way. That scientific argument has spilled out of the journals into social media, blogs, tweets, and the law courts. Dr. Caldera is one of the most famous and respected atmospheric scientists in the world. His home base is the Carnegie Institution for Science in the Department of Global Ecology. Ken has published groundbreaking papers on ocean acidification, geoengineering, and near-zero emissions. He co-authored key papers for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. Ken Caldera, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for that nice introduction.
Well, we're here to talk about the new paper, Geophysical Constraints on the Reliability of Solar and Wind Power in the United States. Ken, to set the big picture, do you think we are already on our way to a new climate?
Yes, we're very definitely causing the planet to get warmer and causing weather patterns to shift around the world. And for the last two decades, it's been clear that humans are the primary cause of this climate change.
And as you know too well, the MIT professor Mark Jacobson published a paper in December 2015 outlining how the United States could power up with just wind, water, and solar. 2 years later, you, along with others, including the lead author Christopher Clack, issued a very negative rebuttal paper, also in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Can you introduce us to the sides of this disagreement?
Yes. I mean, first, let's a little background. Most people doing energy modeling take the existing energy system, the electric grid and power plants and so on, as a given, and then look at, well, how could we, what would we add, or how could we shift from there? And Mark Jacobson did something very useful. He tried to present a vision of what a future near-zero emission energy system would look like. And he severely constrained the option. So he said, let's do it using only, trying to do only wind power, solar power, and hydropower dams. And he concluded, oh, that it would be possible to power all of civilization using only those energy sources. And I guess if you're talking in terms of physical possibility, could we physically do it? I think most people would concur that it's possible. But the question is it feasible in the real world, given real world constraints on how much people are willing to pay and also how much they're willing to tolerate blackouts and so on? And the main issue has to do with getting that last bit of reliability out of our electric sector, and then also about, you know, how to deal with heavy industry. So right now, most of our electricity comes from burning fossil fuels, gas and coal primarily. And most people who want to deal with the climate change problem see replacing those fossil fuel sources, gas, oil, and coal, with wind, solar, maybe electricity, or if we are to use fossil fuels, to capture the carbon dioxide and stuff it underground or someplace else. And so the real issue is that sometimes, even across the entire United States, the wind doesn't blow very much for a couple of weeks at a time. And then, as we all know, in the wintertime, there's less sunlight, and at night, there's no sunlight. And so this question of, well, how do you power modern civilization when the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing is a major question for the reliability of the electric sector. And one of the problems is, I'm sorry for babbling on so long, that batteries are really expensive. The obvious thing would be to just charge a bunch of batteries during the day or during windy times and use them at other times. But batteries would have to get over 100 times cheaper for them really to cost effectively fill that role. And so then people have suggested, well, what about using reservoirs and so on? I don't want to get too far into the weeds here. But if you could get really cheap energy storage, then we could run our electric system off of intermittent wind and solar. But given that storing energy is really hard, and storing electricity in particular is really hard and really expensive. It's hard to see how we get much beyond, say, 80% of our electricity coming from wind and solar. And 80% is a huge fraction. And so, but that's 80% on the annual average. At some particular moments, most of our energy would need to come from some other source. So the question really boils down to the question of electricity storage. Is there a cheap way to store electricity? And that's for the electric side. On the other side, are there good ways to make steel or cement without burning fossil fuels? But that's a different question.
But what about the mega storage projects being installed in Australia by Elon Musk's company? And Statoil is working on it. Maybe mass energy storage is coming.
The storage projects that are being built typically have enough electricity storage to run, you know, the countries they're in for minutes at best, and often seconds. So they're big mega storage site facilities, but when you think of how much electricity an entire country uses, it turns out it's not very much. So, you know, if you have wind power, maybe right now it's gusty, but 15 minutes later it won't be so windy, and then a half hour from then it will be windier. And these kind of battery storage are really good for smoothing out that kind of minute-to-minute gustiness of winds, and maybe a little bit of helping with the afternoon peak of demand and so on. But they're really for smoothing things out within a single day, and not so much for storing energy from one day to the next. So, one of the problems is that if you buy a battery and you're using it every single day, well, then you're getting 365 days a year use of that battery. But if you're trying to use it for seasonal storage, to store, say, solar energy from the summer to the winter, then you're only using that battery once a year. And if you're using it once a year, you have to divide the cost of that battery by one, whereas if you're using it every day, you can divide the cost of that battery by 365. And so to use batteries to store beyond a day starts getting really expensive.
Now, in November of 2014, Mark Jacobson described his plan for all green power here on Radio EcoShock, but he did not talk much about his heavy reliance on a projected renaissance of hydroelectric power. You've seen problems with that.
Yes. One of the ways that Mark Jacobson in his work obtained huge amounts of very cheap storage was to assume that we could get 15 times the amount of electricity from dams in the United States that we currently get. That's an instantaneous flow rate. So, you know, that we would be able to turn on dams and have a total dam flow. I forget exactly the number was, but it was something like 10 or 100 times the flow of the entire Mississippi River. So it was, there was some huge, basically assumed that we could get 15 times the amount of power from dams than we can actually get. And so most people who've studied our energy system thinks that expanding our dams by a factor of 15 is simply impossible.
And your new paper says the limitations of about 80% solar and wind and water are not really social or economic, but geophysical. Why geophysical?
Well, there's been a number. I mean, economics obviously plays into it, but we did a recent paper and we tried to sort of push economics to the background and bring the basic science of how our world functions to the foreground. And if you just look at the modulation of solar energy, it's basically the orbit of the Earth around the sun and the tilt of the Earth in its orbit. And that's modulated by clouds, but there's a certain and fairly predictable amount of sunlight reaching the surface of the Earth. Similarly, the winds and their variability are governed by basic geophysics of our planet's climate system. And there's really issues of the fundamental variability of the winds, even at broad continental scale. So one of the ways that people have suggested getting around the need for large batteries or electricity storage was to make an electric grid, maybe a high voltage direct current grid covering the entire country. And the idea being, well, maybe if it's not windy in Iowa, it'll be windy in Maine. And if you have enough places interconnected, it'll all average out. And so we said, okay, let's imagine you have a perfect electric grid covering the entire contiguous United States. Are the winds really decorrelated enough one place to another that it would all smooth everything out? And we found that that really wasn't true. Even at the scale of the entire continental United States, sometimes you get a couple of weeks where it's not very windy. And so this duration of periods without wind and without very much sun is really a product of the physics of our climate system and not any real economic assumption. So we did an analysis based on the physics of how the winds and the sun go. How much storage would you need to provide different levels of reliability? So we started just from the physics of the climate system rather than the economics of energy systems.
Ken Caldera, I don't want to spend our valuable time together rehashing the lawsuit that Mark Jacobson launched against his scientific critics, but I was alarmed to see another scientist publish his energy critique anonymously in your blog to avoid legal action. Has Jacobson's suit brought a chill to scientific discussion?
Yes, just to back up a little bit, that Mark, we wrote a paper criticizing Mark's paper, suggesting that he made a modeling error in that he did not put any cap on the instantaneous amount of electricity that could be generated by dams in the United States. And so he needed an amount of electricity to be able to be generated by dams that it's comparable to our total energy use, electricity use today. And the idea that we could get all of our electricity today from running dams just is implausible. And he objected to us saying that there was a modeling error, and he claimed that that was a defamation of his character. And instead of using the normal peer review process to address scientific and technical criticism, he resorted to the courts and filed a suit against the National Academy of Sciences and our lead author, Chris Clack. And this suit cost the National Academy several hundred thousand dollars to defend against and cost Chris Clack something like $75,000 to defend against. And when it looked like the judge was going to dismiss the case and also allow what's called an anti-SLAPP case to go forward, which is, I'm going to go into that one later, but when it looked like the judge was going to dismiss the case, Mark withdrew his lawsuit. And there's been rumors of a number of other cases where somebody provided technical criticism of Mark Jacobson's work, and he responded by threatening to sue them in court. And anyway, it's one thing to sue the National Academy, who has substantial resources to defend, but the average working scientist does not want to get embroiled in a lawsuit. And so people have been somewhat reluctant to come out publicly and criticize Mark's work. People have come to me and said, oh, well, I'm up for a tenure decision, and I don't want to get embroiled in these kind of debates be subject to a lawsuit while I'm in a tenure decision, or just people, not everybody can come up with $75,000 to defend against these things. I mean, one of the things that's, if somebody writes up their own lawsuit, the filing fees, I think, are something like $220, and that can cost many tens of thousands of dollars to defend against. And so really, I mean, the way our legal system works, it's very easy for somebody to create big problems for somebody else just by filing a lawsuit against them, harassing them. And, it might be that the National Academy or Chris Clack is able to recover their legal expenses, but right now they're just eating that expense. And so other people don't want to have to go through that. Yeah, so somebody recently provided a critique of Mark Jacobson's treatment of hydropower in his work, and this person was afraid to be publicly associated with their work. So they gave it to me to post on my blog, to get their work out without being personally identified with. And actually, it's interesting. I thought the person who communicated it to me was the writer. I later found out it was somebody else actually wrote it. So I, at the time I published it, I didn't even know who wrote it myself.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. We are talking about the limits to green energy with super scientist Ken Caldera. Ken, your new paper also mentions emergency needs for power, assuming that climate change leads to more and more extreme weather events, drought that could reduce hydropower, fires that can wipe out transmission lines. How does climate change itself feed back into the demand for electricity?
That's a complicated question. And I think the first answer is that it does influence demand, but I think it's a secondary influence in that there's a lot of other technological change, and a lot of technological change goes faster than climate change. If you see over the last decades in the United States, we shifted largely from a manufacturing economy to a service economy, and these kinds of societal changes also have a big influence on demand. And then also we've seen the technologies change, the rise of fracking and natural gas. And so, you know, there's a lot of technical and societal changes that are large, and climate change is just one of many factors shaping the energy system. But one of the things that we can know for demand, that in the South, there's a substantial demand for air conditioning and electricity for cooling purposes, and it's likely that that demand will go up. But conversely, in places like Minnesota and North Dakota, the demand for heating will go down. And so the basic picture is a reduction in heating costs in the northern parts of the United States and an increase in cooling costs in the southern part. The winds are a tougher question. The general theory suggests that it should be a little bit less windy in a warmer world, but that's not a huge effect. So it might be slightly less windy, but that it's not likely to be a huge effect. And so probably the bigger influence would be on heating and cooling costs. Just to say, the air conditioner is an amazing invention. You know, we wouldn't have the cities of Miami or Houston or Atlanta being the modern cities they are without the invention of air conditioning. And one of the major questions for climate change is, you know, will people in poor tropical countries get rich enough to have air conditioners? And that climate change will be a lot tougher to deal with if you're not rich enough to go indoors into an air-conditioned environment.
I think people will either go underground or be air-conditioned if it gets the kind of heat that we're looking at. You've written about a near-zero emissions world, yet this new paper does talk about natural gas as a possible form of dispatchable power. What is dispatchable power, and how could we consider natural gas when the sky's already overfilled with greenhouse gases?
Excellent question. So one could think of basically two types of electricity power sources. There are things like wind and solar that, you know, nature gives you whenever the wind is blowing or the sun is shining. And then there's things like natural gas, which gives you electricity whenever you turn the knob and on and have it generate. And the problem is that you have this variable generation from wind and solar, and then you also have variable demand shifting from minute to minute, from day to day. And so the question is, how do you fill that gap between the variable and intermittent wind and solar production and the variable demand? So you need something that you can turn on and off or throttle forward and back to match that gap. And, you know, if we had enough batteries or enough hydro, that could be it. If we had natural gas, that could be it. Now, there was a study by, two studies actually, one by the branch of the Department of Energy and another by a branch of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. And they both concluded that if we had a bunch of fossil fuel backup, mostly natural gas, that we could get around 80% of our emissions out of our electric generation system. So most of the time we'd be relying on wind and solar, but when wind wasn't blowing, sun wasn't shining, we would run natural gas in the background. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that natural gas is itself a potent greenhouse gas, and when you burn it, you make carbon dioxide, and that's a greenhouse gas, and you'd like to get that out of the system. So So how do you do that? And this is a central challenge, and I don't think anybody has the best answer. It is possible to capture the carbon dioxide from a natural gas plant and stuff that carbon dioxide underground. It's thought that that would more or less double the cost of electricity from natural gas. It's also been suggested that nuclear power could fill that role, but obviously nuclear power is controversial. Maybe batteries could get cheaper, but they'd really have to get like 100 times cheaper for them really to fill that role in an economically sensible way. And so this, so it seems like there's plenty we can do today to get most of the way to the goal of getting carbon dioxide emissions out of our energy system. But that last 20% is still a challenge, and maybe technological innovation would help, or maybe we'll just decide to spend a bunch of money at some point. But right now, it's a pretty daunting technical challenge.
An obvious question likely coming from our listeners, why don't we just reduce our power needs to the 80% capacity that solar, wind, and water can provide?
Yeah, well, that 80% is 80% on a national average over the entire year. But there are certain times when, you know, we might only get one quarter of our power, say, from wind and solar. And, you know, for our national economy to have three quarters of the country in a blackout situation would really have fairly devastating economic consequences. And so that's why it's important in these discussions to think about what's physically possible and what's feasible. And so it's physically possible to shut down three quarters of our economy when the wind's not blowing, but it's probably not politically feasible to do such a thing. That said, I think a lot can be done, maybe not as much as we need, but, you know, things like automating our dishwashers so they run in the middle of the night when electricity demand is low and they turn off in the afternoon, or maybe the refrigerator would cool itself a little bit more in the morning. And then it wouldn't turn on in the afternoon when there's peak power. And so I think, or charging electric cars could be shifted to off-peak hours. And so I think there's a lot that can be done with demand management, and that will help a lot. And it is something that we need to be working on, but it's not going to be enough to do the whole thing on its own.
We just have time for two quick questions. Your paper's about how much of the grid can be supplied by solar, wind, and water in the United States. A new study just came out evaluating the same question in the UK. What did they find?
They found a result very similar to our own, that you can get a substantial amount of emissions reduction through introduction of these intermittent renewables like wind and solar, but that it gets very expensive to get the last bits that way. I mean, the main problem is, you know, let's say you've already gotten enough wind and solar to satisfy 99% of our electrical demand. And now you need to get at a whole bunch more for that 1% of the time when the wind's not blowing. But all that stuff that you add, you're only using it 1% of the time. And so if you're buying something and you're using it all the time, well, then you can distribute that cost over all the time you're using it. But if you're buying something and you're only using it 1% of the time, it becomes really expensive for that 1% of the time. And so you'd really like something that's pretty cheap that you could turn on for those moments. But also, if you can shift that load so you don't need the power that 1% of the time, that would be great.
Are you optimistic we will find a way out in time before rapid climate change overwhelms us?
I'm optimistic when it comes to technology and what we're able to do. But I have to say that given the current state of Congress and the executive branch, that we will get politicians that will make good decisions. I'm increasingly skeptical. So I think from a pure... I don't think it's that big a deal that, you know, economists estimate it would cost us something like 2 or 3% of GDP to solve the climate problem. Right now we're spending, I think, something like close to 8 or 9% on the military budget. We're spending, I think, 18% on healthcare budget. And if we would just make the healthcare budget, say, 20% more efficient, which would still make us have more expensive healthcare than everybody else in the world, that would free up enough resources to solve the climate problem. So I think we could do it. And the problem is really the dysfunction in Washington that is causing our country to fail to address the most pressing problems facing this country today.
The paper, Geophysical Constraints on the Reliability of Solar and Wind Power in the United States, was just published in the journal Energy and Environmental Science. The lead author is Matthew R. Shaner. Our guest and co-author is Dr. Ken Caldera from the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution for Science. To hear all sides and dig deeper, find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ken, thank you so much for taking your incredibly busy time to talk to us about science.
Well, thank you very much for such a well-informed interview. I think this is the most well-informed interview I've done so far on this topic.
Thank you again. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.